I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Podsave the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Podsave the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, strangers, please don't skip this. I've gotten a couple of concerned messages from some of you about political ads that are running on my show. Please know that I have my settings set to no political ads, but unfortunately, some of these companies intentionally mislabel their ads so they can slip through the guardrails. We do whatever we can to prevent this, and when one slips through, we try to get it taken down as quickly as possible. So, if you hear an ad that's completely counter to what you think my beliefs are, please know I did not approve it. And keep letting me know so we can keep a closer eye on it. Also, not for nothing, if you want to skip ads altogether, feel free to subscribe at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where you can get early and ad-free episodes, plus all our other shows. We have 5 running right now with more in the works for just $8 a month. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Have you ever been a part of something that made you feel important or special? Maybe it was a movement or a vocation or even an avocation. Have you ever had a job that felt like more than a job? More like a calling or a mission? Everybody wants to have a purpose. But what if it was all a lie? What if the thing that you thought was your great accomplishment, your contribution to something bigger, was actually your undoing? What if all along that something bigger was hurting you? What if it was killing you? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I have had my share of jobs that felt important and got accolades for doing them. But I would give my Tony Award back in a frog's heartbeat if somehow the work I had done to earn it had come with significant risks to my physical health or my life. Show business can be harmful to one's psyche, but generally speaking, it's not considered a particularly high-risk job. But it's easy to choose health and life over honor when you know you are making that choice. Sadly, in the case of today's episode, people who thought they were doing good, patriotic work had no idea that all the while, that work was exacting a horrific toll. In 1898, Henri Becquerel began studying phosphorescence to see if there was a link to X-rays, which had been recently discovered by a German physicist named Wilhelm Conrad Röntgen. In studying that connection, Becquerel inadvertently discovered radioactivity. Inspired and led by his work, Marie and Pierre Curie famously discovered radium later that same year. Then, after studying radioactive substances for 5 years, Marie Curie, Pierre, and Becquerel were all jointly awarded the Nobel Prize, even though Marie Curie did most of the work and isolated the element radium chloride by herself and discovered another rare and highly radioactive element, polonium. But yeah, of course, they should all have received equal credit. Anyway, in working with these dangerous elements, Marie and the others were themselves exposed to the perils of radioactivity. According to a page on Stanford University's website about Marie Curie, quote, "Throughout her work with radium, Marie was unaware of the effects of radioactivity exposure on the body. In her lab, she would keep tubes of radium in her pocket. She began to suspect that radium negatively impacted health when one of her fellow researchers died of a blood disease. And then a few years later, her personal assistant died of a blood disease. Even though she suspected that radium exposure was bad for her health, she did very little to monitor her own blood. In 1932, she broke her wrist, and the break took much longer to heal than it should have. She then began to notice that her vision was deteriorating, and radiation burns on her fingers were becoming more and more painful. Some days she felt too ill to even go to the lab. And finally, on July 4, 1934, Marie died from aplastic anemia. It wasn't until after Marie's death that they realized, once radium is in the bones, it is extremely difficult to extract. End quote. Nowadays, everyone knows radioactive equals bad, unless you're a Marvel superhero, I guess. But it was not always so. It took a significant amount of additional research, the invention of the atomic bomb, and examples of radiation exposure to really hammer home just how bad radioactive materials could be. But back in its infancy in the early 1900s, there wasn't yet much conclusive information about the properties of radium aside from its charming faint blue glow. For some reason, maybe because the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl, Prohibition, and World War I hadn't happened yet, so people's optimism was still intact, during this time, folks didn't assume the worst about the newfound glowing substance, and in fact, radium began to be hailed as a scientific marvel, a cure-all even. I am not sure what the basis for this confidence in the element was, but people were all about radium. There was little to no regulation of the element at the time. Seeing as it was so new and everyone just decided it was awesome and people were all just scrambling to discover new uses for it, I guess because it seemed really nifty? It glowed in the dark, after all. Doctors and anyone looking to make a buck off the new discovery created all kinds of products that used radium and claimed to heal all manner of ills. Oh, the irony. Radium was suddenly being used as a new remedy in medicine, including as a key element in the treatment of various cancers. It was so popular and sought after for its reputed health benefits that it was infused into consumer products as well, from tonics to cosmetics. According to the Historical Medical Library website, quote, "These products ranged from additives in toothpaste to Revigorator, which was water with radium dissolved in it. Patients would drink from the container throughout the day to cure their ailments." End quote. Whoo boy, radium toothpaste gets your teeth so white they glow. And then they fall out of your gums and down the drain where they will still glow. During this radium craze in 1914, the first radium dial company was founded. It was the eve of World War I, and as the U.S. mobilized its troops to go to Europe to fight, a new demand emerged for military equipment that had glow-in-the-dark gauges and watches so that infantry could see them at night. The U.S. Radium Corporation, USRC, was established in New Jersey to help meet that demand. The company produced state-of-the-art undark paint, a radium-based phosphorescent paint that they used to coat dials in war machines. The paint was invented by former lab assistant to Thomas Edison, William J. Hammer, and it was not only used to make wristwatches and instrument panels visible at night for soldiers, but, according to rarehistoricalphotos.com, quote, "they also marketed the pigment for non-military products such as house numbers, pistol sights, light switch plates, and glowing eyes for toy dolls," end quote. Ads for the substance proudly declared, quote, "Radium, luminous material, shines in the dark," end quote. The power of radium was so great that just 1 microgram could make a watch glow in the dark. With so many new uses for radium and a whole marketplace flourishing with glow-in-the-dark products, additional factories using undark paint opened in Connecticut and Illinois to meet the high demand for these products. Again, safety precautions around radium at this time were virtually non-existent. Radium was widely thought to be harmless or even beneficial in small doses. So, as you can imagine, all kinds of nonsense happened with the unregulated substance. In a 2024 interview with science journalist Deborah Blum from the podcast Tiny Matters, Blum tells of some of the uses of radium. Quote, "They used to actually take chunks of uranium and put them into spas so that people could swim in the glow of this underground sun. There's all kinds of tonics and candies and makeup and drinks that give you energy, all using the wonderful glow of radiation," end quote. Somehow I doubt they actually gave anyone energy.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
In spring of 1917, USRC in New Jersey hired hundreds of young women to work in their factories. As the men went to war, need increased in the working world back home, especially in the factories that manufactured arms and other wartime necessities such as glow-in-the-dark dials. And who didn't want to be part of the war effort? One such worker, 18-year-old Grace Fryer, and her peers jumped at the chance to paint instrument dials with undark paint. After all, right off the bat, the job paid extremely well. Girls who worked at these factories made about three times what they would have doing other factory work. And the job was kind of glamorous, for working class girls anyway, because not only were they doing their patriotic duty, but they were the special population chosen to work with the trendy, in-demand new shiny element, radium. Workers at Radium Dial were trained to paint dials and other equipment by using what was called a lip-dip paint routine. A painter would twirl the brush in between her lips to sharpen it to a fine point, then dip the brush into the patented shining radium paint and paint the tiny numbers on the dial. They repeated this routine over and over throughout their workday, during which they were expected to produce a minimum of 250 dials. Workers were paid 1.5 cents per dial. So if they made their quota, these young women would make $89.25 a day, or $2,050 in today money. Say what? Per day? Okay, strangers, that is big money by any standards. Considering that the average factory worker in the U.S. today only makes about $135 a day, and the cost of living today is 32 times higher than it was in the early 1900s, it's easy to see why people wanted to be dial painters so badly. It also seems pretty red flaggy to me that a factory job would offer pay that was on par with what a college-educated professional of the same era would make. We call that hazard pay nowadays, don't we? But everyone back then thought radium was great. It was a panacea. These workers were not just making bank, they were getting to reap the wondrous health benefits while also helping the troops. It doesn't get any better than that, right? Well, while many people did believe in the wonders of radium, the management of Radium Dial might not actually have been among them. It seems management was aware that radium might not be so great, which means they knowingly put their workers at risk. In America? No, I can't believe it. TheArchive.com writes, quote, SRC's upper management was well aware of the dangers inherent to handling radioactive material, making every effort to avoid touching it themselves. End quote. Ew, don't touch that weird glowy paint. Except for you, young ladies, do your civic duty and get up in there. Put it in your mouths! Managers stuck to the American capitalist script and assured their workers that the paint, which dial makers had to mix themselves, was perfectly safe. With that assurance, the archive says of the women in the factories, quote, sometimes they amused themselves during their long shifts by coating their faces, nails, and teeth with the glowing paint. One worker, Grace Fryer, observed that when she blew her nose after a day at the factory, her handkerchief glowed green, end quote. And one coal miner observed that when he coughed, his handkerchief turned black. And in an historical preservation PDF from NewJersey.gov, we are told, quote, until 1920, the dial painters were allowed to eat at their workstations without washing their hands, end quote. Ooh, I guess public health just wasn't a thing then. The plague of 1918 be damned. Never mind that by the end of the shift, Grace and her co-workers' hair and skin would glow from the luminous dust of the paint that they worked with. The girls at the factory considered this an amusing novelty, a charming byproduct of their work, a point of pride even. It even became popular to wear fancy outfits to the plant so they would glitter when they went out after work. As author Deborah Blum reminds us in her book The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York, quote, the painters were teenage girls and young women who became friendly during their hours together and entertained themselves during breaks by playing with the paint. They sprinkled the luminous liquid in their hair to make their curls twinkle in the dark, end quote. Unlike me, when I took ecstasy and went to Manhattan nightclub The Limelight at age 16, they had no idea they were engaging in risky behavior. They were just being young girls, and radium was glamorous. Radium had even made its way to the stage. Back in 1902, actress and dancer Loie Fuller wrote to Marie and Pierre Curie to enlist their help in making a costume for a new dance. She wanted a costume that featured butterfly wings of radium. It's interesting to note that the Curies actually tried to warn Fuller about the possible danger of using radium, and according to the Society for Theater Research, quote, gently dissuaded her and steered her towards using other, less dangerous materials, end quote. Despite the Curies' warnings, Loie Fuller pressed on, and in 1904 debuted the Radium Dance in Paris, London, and the United States. The dance was a success and earned her accolades. One performance was described by a journalist this way, quote, through a slit in the curtain opposite a green glow is seen. Suddenly, an apparition comes into view. It is a vague form, only distinguished by the hundreds of tiny glow worms which it seems to carry on its flowing raiment. The tissue of twinkling stars floats about, circles, sweeps along the floor, or is wafted up until it is shaped into a sort of great luminous vase. The dancer's face is never seen. Her form is vaguely divined when outlined by the glowing lights. The apparition vanishes to be followed by another more weird still. Above a perfectly invisible head, which you only suppose to be there, shines a bluish halo. Below, clothing an unseen figure, is a long robe, which is merely one great patch of the same ghostly light. The apparition slowly moves to a solemn rhythm, seems to invoke heaven, the halo being thrown backwards when the head is, as you conclude, uplifted, and finally the robe of light sinks on the floor when you infer that the figure kneels. The second ghost vanishing, a third appears, a monster glowing moth with shining antenna a foot long, eyes which are globes of light, and wings 6 feet high, glittering with luminous scrolls in all colors. The moth flutters round and round the studio, then out of our sight, but reappears instantly, accompanied by a smaller, glowing white butterfly, which beats its wings over the monster luminous insect's head. Lamps being relit, we are brought back to reality out of Ghostland, and having an opportunity of examining the dancers' dresses, find that they are made of a peculiar kind of silk, completely impregnated with certain fluorescent salts. In complete darkness, the only portions of material thus rendered luminous are visible. End quote. Whoa. I'm not gonna lie, that sounds amazing. I wish I could have seen it through binoculars from a very healthy distance away while wearing a hazmat suit. What theater was this in again? I want to make note of it so I don't ever go there. Fuller's dance wasn't even the only radium-inspired theater out there. There was the song Radium Dance, written by Gene Schwartz for a Broadway musical called Piff Paff Poof, which opened in 1904. The producer of the show was, according to Society for Theater Research, quote, said to have bought the exclusive rights for the use of radium paint in the U.S. from the L.D. Gardner Company, end quote. The Radium Dance was a huge success, so much so that another number was added to the end of the musical, also using glow-in-the-dark materials. Give the people what they want. Note, I don't think we will be seeing a revival of Piff Paff Poof anytime soon. And if there is one, please don't call me to audition. Still, from the magical description of Louis Fuller's ethereal performance, it is easy to see how radium held people in thrall, in spite of any rumors that may have circulated of its danger. It's also easy to see how the factory workers and those that used radium for its cosmetic appeal began to be called the Ghost Girls by the press. Sadly, few knew how prescient that nickname would be for these young workers. They thought they were just working and playing and looking cute, but all the while, radiation was slowly accumulating in their bones. I couldn't find any information about whether the Curies tried to warn the industry around the wartime effort about using all that radium on dials and watches and stuff. But hell, maybe their brains were cooked from all their own radium exposure. It's said that Marie Curie used radium in a vial as a nightlight, and that the couple's research books were kept locked away because they were so radioactive. People who consistently expose themselves to that much radioactivity might not have had the best judgment.
I'm Alastair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September. I'm Alastair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
It wasn't until around 1920 that the first real signs that radium wasn't harmless started to appear. Young women from the plants who were otherwise healthy started to report toothaches in large numbers. Also, jaw pain and fatigue were symptoms that appeared to be on the rise. Dentists were seeing a rapid increase in tooth extractions that just weren't healing as they should have. In some patients, mysterious ulcers were being reported. Anemia and weight loss were becoming more common. Initially, doctors were baffled by this puzzling array of symptoms. Many of the women affected had left the dial company years before, making the cause and effect harder to see as it took some time for these illnesses to manifest. Then, in 1922, Amelia Molly Maggia, a former dial painter at the New Jersey plant, died. Molly was just 24, and her death was gruesome. In the months leading up to her death, Molly suffered from agonizing mouth infections. All of her teeth fell out, one by one. Then, Molly's jawbone literally disintegrated. Her dentist removed her entire lower jaw simply by lifting it out of her face after it broke into pieces. Absolutely horrifying. I cannot begin to imagine the pain Molly must have been in. And no one, not one person, knew why this terrible thing was happening to her. No one knew how to help her. To make the heartbreak worse, Molly's official cause of death was listed on her death certificate as syphilis. This incorrect and cruel diagnosis tarnished Molly's reputation and cast a shameful shadow on her untimely death, leaving her family with more pain and confusion in the wake of her loss. Even worse, the erroneous diagnosis deflected blame from the workplace that had actually killed her. In New Jersey, between 1923 and 1924, dozens of former dial painters began exhibiting symptoms similar to Molly's. Doctors fielded reports of jaw necrosis, rampant dental infections, bone pain, and anemia. Within a year, at least four ghost girls had died, and many others were gravely ill. Meanwhile, across the country in Ottawa, Illinois, radium dial company's young female employees started to exhibit symptoms as well. Physicians and the families of the afflicted continued to be unsure of the cause for this outbreak of unusual extreme tooth decay, and other illnesses, but for the first time, some considered the possibility of an occupational link. As this was happening, though, of course, the companies who used it continued to insist to their workers and everyone else that radium was safe. Nothing to see here, folks. What no one knew, even those who knew it was a risky substance, was that radium's chemical makeup is similar enough to calcium that the body will actually start to store it in the same place as calcium is stored, like in the bones. Eventually, with continued exposure, radium will replace the calcium and those bones will literally crumble. Amid a concerning number of illnesses and symptomatic current and former employees, in 1924, the New Jersey factory USRC finally decided to commission an independent investigation into the health of the dial painters. Dr. Cecil Drinker, a professor at Harvard University's School of Public Health, was enlisted. His study concluded that there was, in fact, a link between the women's illnesses and radium exposure at work. Okay, look at Harvard, on the right side of history then and now. Kate Moore, in her book The Radium Girls, The Dark Story of America's Shining Women, quoted a letter dated June 3, 1924, in which Dr. Cecil Drinker wrote to USRC President Arthur Roeder saying, quote, "We believe that the trouble which has occurred is due to radium. It would, in our opinion, be unjustifiable for you to deal with the situation through any other method of attack." End quote. Drinker observed that the factory was covered in radium dust and noted that the lip-dip paint technique workers were taught had led to widespread ingestion of radium. In a 2013 article published in the Harvard School of Public Health's online journal, Drinker was quoted as saying that every inch of the painters glowed, even the corsets. On hearing the horrendous news that Drinker had to share, USRC was shocked, bereft, and remorseful, and promptly apologized, promising to generously compensate the families of the ill and the dead. They immediately discontinued use of radium and launched a speedy effort to contain any health or environmental impact they had caused. Just kidding. LOL. Could you imagine? As the young women who worked for the dial paint companies continued to develop anemia, bone pain, and the especially terrifying jaw deterioration that would later become known as radium jaw, where their teeth fell out and jaw bones fully disintegrated, U.S. Radium Corp. and Radium Dial Company denied all responsibility. As those same workers and former workers died, the companies denied all responsibility. The internal reports clearly showed the dangers that had previously been hidden, but company executives suppressed the findings and misled regulators at every turn. Doctors who cared for the women continued to be baffled, and some victims continued to be misdiagnosed with ailments like rheumatism or, like poor Molly Maggia, even syphilis. It seems likely, in some of these cases, that the doctors passing out these horrible misdiagnoses were actually employed by the dial paint companies and were encouraged by management to give these erroneous explanations for the girls' ill health to hide the truth and smear the women's reputations, discrediting them in the public eye. Speaking of which, have you heard Amazon is now offering medical services? Everything is fine. Radium dial officials went to extraordinary lengths to hide the real cause of the sickness plaguing their workers. They not only denied the link to radium, but engaged in actual corporate espionage. According to a 2018 story about the Radium Girls on NPR, following the death of Margaret Peg Looney, one of the first Ottawa dial painters to die from radium poisoning, Radium Dial staff in Illinois literally snatched evidence in the form of radioactive bone fragments to prevent proof of what radium in the body could do. Apparently, Radium Dial agreed to an autopsy with the Looney's family doctor present, but when the doctor arrived, the autopsy had already been completed, raising suspicion that the company had tampered with or removed evidence. When Grace Fryer, back in New Jersey, and other workers in Illinois, like Catherine Donahue, became gravely ill, just as Molly and so many others had, it became clear to them that something had to be done. Grace, who personally sustained severe spinal damage and pervasive jaw issues from radium exposure, became the lead plaintiff in the first Radium Girls lawsuit. A 2021 piece on Medium by Shay Keating recalls, quote, she convinced four other women, Edna Hussman, Catherine Schaub, Quinta McDonald, and Albina Larice, collectively called the Radium Girls, to join her in suing the company. Grace wanted U.S. Radium to take responsibility for the illnesses of its workers, pay medical bills for those it had impacted, and implement safety measures to prevent exposure in the future. It took Grace over 2 years to find a lawyer that was willing to take the Radium Girls case to court. By the time the case was heard, two of the Radium Girls were bedridden. None of them were strong enough to raise their right hand to take the oath before testifying. End quote. In the media, where the Radium Girls were called the Society of the Living Dead, Grace was famously quoted as saying, quote, it is not for myself I care. I am thinking more of the hundreds of girls to whom this may serve as an example, end quote. Grace's courage and tenacity made her a symbol of the fight. According to njradiumgirls.weebly.com, quote, on May 18, 1927, Barry filed a lawsuit against the USRC on behalf of the women, each asking for $2,500,000 in damages for pain and medical expenses, end quote. Meanwhile, in Illinois, Catherine Donahue worked with her own lawyer to hold Radium Dial Company accountable. As these legal battles became more public, with the press jumping at the chance to plaster photos of the ailing and weakened plaintiffs on their front pages, the Radium Girls gained the support of science.
I'm Alastair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September. I'm Alastair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Researchers like Dr. Harrison Martland studied radium's effect on the body, and by 1925 developed tests that detected radioactivity in the women's bodies and pinpointed radium as the culprit for their growing health issues. Deborah Blum on the Tiny Matters podcast recounted events leading up to the clear understanding that something really bad was happening with radium after Martland started looking at the sick women and performed his tests. Blum says, quote, one of them, and the one that really stuck with me, is he discovers these women, both still at the factory and the ones who have retired due to illnesses, are exhaling radon gas. He's like, what in the world is going on? Why would they be exhaling radon gas? End quote. What was going on was the women were so filled with radium that they were breathing out a gas that was essentially a breakdown product of radium. When they realized this, Blum tells us, Martland contacted New York Chief Medical Examiner Charles Norris and toxicologist Alexander Gettler, who exhumed the bones of Molly Maggia and did a series of experiments on them. Quote, with photographic paper, just essentially seeing if light will spatter on negatives. He grinds the bones into pieces, or he wraps them in the photographic paper. Then he takes a comparison group of bones from someone who just died in an auto accident or something. Those films are dark, but the bones from this young woman are like a constellation. That's how I see it when I see these images. It's like stars spattered across this dark sky. All of those stars are points of radioactive contact. End quote. As the evidence mounted, and in spite of the aggressive efforts by the factories to hide it, Grace and the other plaintiffs won their case in court. 8 times. The dial plants kept appealing. After the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, the Radium Girls finally won their lawsuit for good in 1939, when U.S. Radium was found responsible for their radium poisoning, and the plaintiffs were each paid $10,000 in damages, which is about $151,000 in today money. The Radium Girls' legal and medical expenses were paid in full. I guess it was something, but it doesn't sound like nearly enough to me. And unfortunately, though she did reluctantly accept a small settlement in 1928, Grace Fryer did not live to see the end of the case she started and fought so hard for. She died in October of 1933. She was just 34 years old. Grace's legacy was, however, more than just the payout that the Radium Girls received. The case led to important changes in labor laws and to the greater worker protections we enjoy today, contributing to the eventual establishment of OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the same OSHA that Trump wants to dismantle. Radium was largely removed from consumer products by the mid-1930s. What's more, the radium dial companies were irrevocably changed by the legal action taken by Grace and Catherine. A piece on HubPages sums it up, quote, "Both companies were forced to change their names and downsize in the wake of the firestorm. World War II kept both in business for another decade or so, but the 1950s and 60s saw the luminous industry shift away from radium use when it no longer became profitable to mine it. Eventually, both would close by the 1970s. Ironically, their facilities were quarantined by the EPA and designated Superfund cleanup sites due to the radioactive waste that had permeated into the ground. Today, radioactive waste disposal is still being performed in both Orange, New Jersey, and Ottawa, Illinois," end quote. So the damage to the radium industry and its related businesses was deep and far-reaching. Also, the EPA, another agency in Trump's crosshairs. Let's hope they don't roll back every regulation that has protected us for the last 100 years and decide to start using radium as medicine again under RFK's Department of Health and Human Services. I honestly wouldn't put it past the man with the brainworm who thinks autism is caused by vaccines. The point is, stranger, the establishment of these oversight agencies were not just arbitrary. They came into existence for good reason. To keep an eye on those that would make money and line their pockets at the expense of the lives and well-being of the very people who worked for them. To hold the wealthy accountable and to make sure industry can't thrive if the people who make it function don't. Does this sound all too familiar? This is what Grace, Catherine, and the other Radium Girls fought for. If these agencies of oversight are dismantled, then what remains of the painful legacy of the Radium Girls? Radium has a half-life of about 1,600 years, meaning it could be around even longer than human greed. Never mind, human greed is infinite. Grace's body and the remains of the other U.S. radium workers will still glow when the rest of us are long gone. May their irradiated, luminous bones remind us forevermore what comes of putting profit ahead of people. Let their deaths mean something. Let the Radium Girls be the ultimate reminder that we can always fight, no matter how weak we think we are, and we can still win. Even when things are crumbling, we can still be part of something important and special, something bigger, something that outshines greed. Next time on Strange and Unexplained. By World War II, Prince George, aka the Duke of Kent, had finally settled down and reformed his debaucherous, scandalous ways. In August of 1942, he was sent on a secret mission on a plane that crashed into the Scottish Highlands. To this day, no one knows why he was on that plane, who he was going to see, or what he was doing. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment with help from Grabbag Collab. This episode was written by Eve Kerrigan and me, Daisy Egan, with research by Becky Berger. Sound design and engineering by Jeff Devine. Music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab, or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.